Welcome to this week's episode of Rise and Shine, the weekly public affairs program on 93.1 The Wolf. I'm Tammy, I'm your host, and anytime I have a question about anything gardening related, I know exactly who to ask, my friend Toby Bost. Toby is a master gardener who worked with the Forsyth County Cooperative Extension Service for years before he recently retired. He's also written several gardening books, and he volunteers with the Paul Senior Botanical Gardens in Kernersville. So from melons to mums, nightshades to shade trees, he knows his stuff. So I'm glad he's agreed to join us this week on Rise and Shine to talk about some of the issues that folks are having in their gardens right now and to help us have a productive season this year. So, Toby, first of all, since the last time we talked, you've written a children's book. Tell me more about that. What age range is it for, and what's it all about?
Good. And it's a story about a couple kids, kind of inner-city kids, who meet a master gardener, and they learn about the garden in their neighborhood, and then they learn a little bit about character education. So it's kind of the respect for his garden, and then I won't tell the end of the story, but kind of a little look at the end there to kind of get the kids interested in gardening. So it should work for 10-11 year olds, but it's really geared towards understanding a couple concepts in science. And then I have included a section in the back of the book for teachers to let the kids do some plant studies and to answer some basic botany or horticulture questions about how plants grow and the culture of plants and what plants need to to thrive and that kind of thing. Just to give them a workbook. It's really more of a workbook than a children's story.
And what's the title of the book?
It's called The Green Zoo.
And where can people get a copy?
The Green Zoo's available as an ebook through lulu.com. That's the publisher. And also it's in hard copy too.
Well, that's great. I wish you the best with your book. So before our conversation today, I asked friends what kind of issues they were having, what questions they had for you. And the number one response was how to deal with critters. You do all this work to get your plants going and they start coming up and you get excited only to find out that the lovely woodland critters surrounding your house have decided to use your garden as a buffet. So what's your recommendation for dealing with that?
Yeah, well, I got a lot of practical experience at the Arboretum at Tanglewood Park, because I was director of the Arboretum there. And so we had a healthy population of deer, and that seemed to be a challenge for us because we did not have the acre and a half of, plants fenced in, and excluding deer is a challenge unless you go up with like a 9-foot fence. And most people, either they don't want to spend the money for the fence or they'd rather try other options. And so we actually used a liquid repellent called, in fact, the name was Liquid Fence. And as long as we applied it a couple times a month, it seemed to work well. And it had egg-based solids in it and a couple other herbal type additives. And it did seem to work for moving the deer to another area, but they love to browse. And if you get a rain, most of the repellents on the market, they're so short-lived that they just, it just gets expensive to repeat and apply as often as you need to. But there are a lot of remedies. But fencing, and actually a double fence, is what most zoologists recommend. Those who've studied the problem with deer, it's just their depth perception is the issue, and you kind of play on that to try to have, not one fence, but two fences. Yeah, just, a couple feet apart, and deer will be reluctant to jump over and jump across. But the other thing seemed to be, the groundhogs, the skunks that like to dig in the ground. Rabbits certainly love to nibble on plants. And so there are a lot of critters or pests that enjoy our gardens as well. And so it's generally some type of fencing to exclude them is about the best recommendation. There are a lot of things out there people use. They'll use hair, they'll use some of the highly scented soaps, any type of noise maker, pie pans, you've seen it all, scarecrows. I mean, all those things tend to work in the short run. So that is a challenge for a lot of gardeners, and you just have to plant more plants than you really want. If you're doing vegetables, you just plant plant a large garden, and hopefully you'll get enough produce or whatever to make it worth the while. But it is a challenge with small gardens.
Okay, so that covers the big critters, but what about the little ones? For example, I have eggplant growing this year, and almost from the very beginning, the leaves have had little holes in them. I've looked for some kind of caterpillar or something. I haven't seen anything eating them, but obviously something is. So what about the creepy crawlies?
Well, with eggplant, about the time the eggplant really starts flourishing, leaf beetles, flea beetles, actually, the technical beetle, they'll come up out of the ground, and you know, and so large numbers of them. They love to, they'll eat on peppers, but on eggplant more so. And it just looks like a little shot hole all through the leaves. And what some gardeners will do, and you can kind of talk about, there are a lot of insecticides on the market, some organic, some more protective, like soaps and oils and neem and there's just a number of these products out there that you can use that will maybe help you get through a peak time where there's a lot of feeding and injury, and that may be all you need to the plants start growing. But they seem to be a little more vulnerable in the spring. Often the beneficials that tend to suppress damaging insects tend to, those populations tend to lag behind other pests. So you know the thinking in organic about bi-rational treatment with gardens is you don't want to do a lot of treatment early in the season to allow the beneficials to catch up, and then they naturally suppress.
So when you have leaves that are chewed up by something like my eggplant leaves, and with other plants too, is that a cosmetic issue, or does it affect the fruit or vegetables you're trying to grow?
In a lot of cases, it is cosmetic with insects, but you can, you know, when you get into things like snap beans, for example, there are some leaf beetles that can consume a lot of foliage, and at some point, you know, your production goes down. They just don't, you know, they just don't bear well for you. Same thing with corn. You know, a lot of people want to grow sweet corn, and corn earworms and corn stalk borers and, you know, Japanese beetles even. There's just a lot of things that will come in on certain plants, and you know, you have to do a little research on that to know how to treat with a plant like that might, you know, or a pest that might kill a plant. But by and large, I'm just trying to think through some of the plants that we grow in our garden. We have probably about a quarter of an acre of community garden in downtown Kernersville. And so we have quite a variety of things. And I'm trying to think, as of today, about the pest-wise, the worst thing I've seen, we're starting to see some squash vine borers show up, and where the plant basically just breaks off its soil line after so much feeding in the stalk, or like I said, snap beans, you start to get leaf beetles. So, I mean, those are some of the things, but we're early in the season, and plants are growing really fast, and we tend to have minimal pest damage right now. It's going to pick up in another few weeks, but we're doing real well now.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Rise and Shine, the weekly public affairs program on 93.1 The Wolf. I'm Tammy, I'm your host, and today we're talking with Master Gardener Toby Bost. And Toby, so far we've talked about pests, big and small, but what other issues might people be encountering in their gardens right now?
There are going to be leaf diseases, and we've had so much rain this year that the leaf diseases are just starting to show up. And the critical thing with locating a vegetable garden, particularly a vegetable garden, is you want good bright sun, especially in the east exposure, east or south, so you get good bright light in the morning, dries the foliage off quickly in the morning, and you've got really good air movement. And it's kind of akin to locating a site to grow like hybrid tea roses, the same way. So you got to have bright sun, you want it in the morning, you want good air movement, and that minimizes leaf diseases. So that seems to be the biggest challenge for a lot of gardeners growing tomatoes, is some of the leaf diseases. And so variety selection, selecting varieties that we know have some resistance to leaf diseases is beneficial, particularly with tomatoes. So that, and just thinning out foliage sometime, that's the lower foliage, lifting it up off the ground so it doesn't touch the ground, using newspapers or mulch or compost, anything of that nature to keep the soil covered so the fungus disease spores don't, you know, splash from the soil back onto the foliage. So that, you know, just good hygiene, if you will, in the garden and removing blighted leaves and things like that are things that you do on like a, you know, weekly basis is, or even a daily basis, walk through and kind of keep an eye on the foliage of plants and you know, get rid of foliage that has some type of leaf spot on it. Not so much the holes from the insects, but you know, leaf spot diseases usually start. Hopefully it's not going to be as wet as it's been the last couple months. So this has been a crazy spring with cool nights and a lot of rain. And so hopefully we're going to get into, you know, consistent summer weather where it is, you know, drier. And that's really helpful as you go into summer with disease control.
Okay. And speaking of tomatoes, I know a lot of people, as in me, who seem to have a big problem growing tomatoes and blossom end rot. Am I watering too much? Am I not watering enough? What is going on with that?
Well, it usually is a water relation to things and calcium uptake. That's really what it is a deficiency of calcium in the fruit. And that can be aggravated by too little, too much rain. Historically, it's typically dry soil that tends to create more problems with blossom end rot. It tends to show up later, but it's also a function of fertilizer too. So you have to, a lot of gardeners with tomatoes will either buy a special tomato fertilizer, you know, whether it's an organic or, you know, a special mix made for tomatoes that's high in calcium, or they'll buy calcium nitrate if they're usually a farmer, they would buy calcium nitrate. And the other thing it goes back to is making sure the soil pH is at least 6, pH 6 to 6.5. And that's normally done before the season started through a soil test. But you can do a soil test any time of year. And it is a free service in North Carolina, so they can have that soil analyzed at the agronomic lab in Raleigh. And so that getting the pH... maintaining the pH level that's above 6 normally frees up calcium that may or may not be available to the plant. And so some gardeners will spray with a blossom set material, or they'll spray plants with calcium chloride solution a few times as a preventative to make sure it's, you know, the calcium is there. Typically, you want to make sure you got plenty of calcium in the soil, and the pH is about 6 or 6.5, something like that, and keep them moist in the summer when you're setting a lot of fruit.
Well, let's talk about watering a little bit more. You can either water too much, you can water not enough. Where's the sweet spot with watering?
Watering's really part of the art of gardening. But the rule of thumb, and farmers would use, you needed the equivalent of an inch to an inch and a half of water a week. And that's just to replace water loss used by the plant and evaporation and wind, you know, and such as that. So that can be measured with a rain gauge, or you can have a drip irrigation system and it's set so you know how much water you're putting on. We haven't needed a lot of water this year. So we've had plenty of water and excessive, really. But as you get into typical summer weather, you need the equivalent of an inch of rain a week. And so whether we don't get it, you need to do some either hand watering or, like I said, some type of trickle or drip irrigation. It's what some gardeners will do on, you know, larger spaces. You know, if you have an oscillating sprinkler or flapper type sprinkler, whatever type of irrigation system you use, you literally can set out cans. Little tuna fish cans or something like that around if you've got an overhead watering system. Literally measure, and I'd say probably twice a week, put on a half inch twice a week, and it gives you your inch of rain. Mulches help to maintain the soil moisture, so you can kind of pull the mulch back and stick your finger in the soil, and if it's wet an inch down, it's probably wet enough.
So I'm doing all of my gardening in containers. Does that change how much I have to water?
With container gardening, you have the advantage of the plant wilting actually and that would be a sign that you do need to water. But in general, and it depends on the soil mixes that you use, if it's a very sandy mix or with a lot of pine bark composites or things of that nature, it's probably going to dry out really quickly. You can almost count with container gardening to water almost every day. So you either have to have some type of drip system set up or just have to be available to water. And that becomes more acute as you go into the summer season. Large containers, generally for vegetables, larger containers are generally not going to dry out quite as fast. And the higher the vertical height of the container, the higher it is, taller it is, it's generally going to drain faster. A lot of raised bed gardens, you know, they're a little lower and more horizontal. They don't dry out quite as fast. And so you got the factor of knowing the type of soil mix that you're using and how much organic matter is in there, and then kind of the shape of the container. All that's going to impact how you water. And so that can be a little tricky. I think a lot of gardeners, just like if they've never grown things in a conventional way in a raised bed, they want to go to container gardening to eliminate the weeding. And that's probably the big advantage. The watering can be a bigger challenge than the weeds, in my opinion.
So I was introduced to a new concept this year with tomato growing, thanks to YouTube, and that is suckering. I've never pulled off the suckers on a tomato plant before, those little sprouts that grow between the main stalk and one of the leaf branches, I guess. I've never pulled those off, but apparently some people think you should. What do you think?
You know, it's kind of two schools of thought on tomatoes, whether you sucker them or not. And I think if you have plenty of sunlight and you're going to trellis your tomatoes and tie them and stake them such as that, then you could probably and probably should sucker them and grow two or three main stems, if you will, and let those produce the plant. But if you have large tomato cages, and we were talking about blossoming rot earlier, I think some studies I saw some years ago is the tomatoes that were in oversized tomato cages that were not suckered tend to have less blossom end rot, and their yields were a little bit higher too. So like I said, some gardeners just get some welded wire and they'll make a large cage that's probably 3-4 foot in diameter, and they'll kind of stake that in the garden and put a Better Boy tomato or something in it and not sucker at all, just let it fill up the space. And you know, again, probably a little less blossom end rot and more tomatoes.
So one thing we haven't really talked about yet is fertilizer. What are your thoughts on that?
Once your plants have set fruit, and the term we would use, you do need to do farmers would call side dress, adding a little fertilizer about every 3 to 4 weeks, or using a slow release fertilizer that would generally give you 6 to 8 weeks. And so we do have to keep that nitrogen there. And usually the lower leaves will tend to turn yellow. A good indication you need nitrogen. And that tends to be the main thing that vegetables need, is that extra nitrogen. And we have to apply that usually with, you know, every 3 to 4 weeks. Or a lot of container gardeners, they just use almost like a weekly or a continuous feed with one of the soluble fertilizers. And that's certainly the way we grow plants in a greenhouse, is, you know, with something like Miracle-Gro or Peters or Fertilome, one of these liquid plant foods you mix with water. And so when you water, you're feeding the plant. And tends to work great for container production.
All right. So let's say we've done everything right so far. You know, we've taken care of the pests and the leaf diseases, and we've watered the right amount and fertilized the right amount. And finally, we've got fruits and vegetables growing. So do we just start picking all willy-nilly, or is there a method to the harvesting?
Fortunately, if you grew things from seed, there's usually a maturity date. It'll tell you your corn's going to be ready to harvest in 90 days, or your, you know, I grew some pak choi this year in some containers, and it said harvest mature in 30 to 40 days. So you kind of have that, you know, little information if you have a seed tag, seed label. And that's helpful because you get into, you know, beans or squash or whatever. Gardeners may tend to let them get too large, and then they get pithy, or they get stringy, or they get seedy, and the quality goes down if you leave them too long in the sun and the heat. And the other thing is, when you harvest, get them out of the sun immediately. Preferably bring them in where, you know, at least where they're shaded, if not in the house where it's air conditioner, or as quickly as you can into a refrigerated unit to maintain the quality for any vegetable material, or plastic bags or saran wrap or something like that on leafy things. And the more you harvest on a lot of these vegetables, the more produce you're going to get. And so I guess some new gardeners are a little reluctant to, they don't want to over-harvest, but if you leave too many fruit on, I'm thinking kind of in my mind, all the different squashes, you know, that we grow, that if you leave too many fruit on, you're going to get, you know, you're going to cut your harvest, the quantity down. So don't be reluctant to harvest or cut the leafy things, or, you know, harvest the beans or whatever and keep them coming.
Well, this has been a lot of information, and I know it's just the tip of the iceberg, lettuce. Sorry. So where do people go to get more information about growing their gardens, Toby? I know you have a couple of really great books, but what do you recommend people do?
Most of my books that I have released are more towards landscape gardening, the flowers, shrubs, trees, ground covers, things of that nature. So those usually like Carolina Gardener's Guide, something like that. But there is the same publisher that did my book did a book on growing vegetables in North Carolina, and it's Cool Springs Press. So that's a great book. And then, of course, you can Google and get so much information now about North Carolina gardening. And NC State has a great website on North Carolina gardening, too. So just a lot of information out through Cooperative Extension online that's free. And
this has been such great information. Thank you so much for all of your time. My guest today again, Toby Boss, Master Gardener, author of several wonderful gardening books as well. And that'll do it for another episode of Rise and Shine, the weekly public affairs program right here on 93.1 The Wolf. We'll be back again next week to do it again. Until then, shine on, Wolf Nation.